We should go straight to the Q&A. Is that a good idea? Yeah, because now it's getting late and it's a long, long retreat, so maybe it's a good thing. Okay, good. I'm glad you think that's a good idea. Then we will do it that way. So if you want to, we can have a bit of discussion and Q&A or whatever, and then see what happens. And if we want to, we can even go a little bit longer than usual, if you wish. We'll see what happens. So I will wait patiently for the questions to arrive. Okay, thank you. Excellent. Okay, so let's start, and as always, you are more than welcome just to come in and kind of ask again if you don't feel I have answered the question rightly or I haven't understood what you're trying to say or whatever. Please just grab the microphone and we can have a bit of a discussion about it. So first one, dear Ajahn, relating to Samyutta Nikaya 47.8, which is the Cook Samyutta, page 89, what does it mean by they don't take the mind's hint? or they take the mind's hint? Is it referring to how we should adjust our meditation practice depending on what state our mind is in at a different stage? The idea is that you don't really grasp, that there is a hindrance or there is a problem there. You don't fully, you're not able to fully see what is happening in the mind and to kind of make the right adjustment so as to overcome those hindrances. That is really kind of what is meant here by the hint. It's the same thing as the hint of the cook. Yeah, the cook is making the food. He doesn't see what's going on. He doesn't kind of take notice of what is happening. In the same way, you don't take notice of what's happening in your mind in the right way so as to overcome the hindrances. That is kind of the point there. But if you are sharp, if you are careful, if you follow the instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, you investigate what the problem is, you try to figure out what is going on, you try to investigate the source of the problem, how does it come about, and then you learn through that to kind of overcome what the issue is. So you have to kind of use the techniques and the skills that are kind of laid down in the Satipatthana Sutta and elsewhere in the suttas as well. So you kind of adjust and you kind of learn as you go along with that one. Does that make sense? Yeah? People are happy with that? Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is the origin of the 5 precepts and the 8 precepts? Is it written in the suttas or the Vinaya Pitaka? Also, in the 5th precept, how is intoxication defined in today's context? Is addiction to social media, gambling, and chasing after the latest trend considered intoxication? Okay. So, maybe we should add some more precepts. I think that might be a good idea, actually. Cannot go to Facebook or that sort of stuff. Actually, maybe Facebook is probably already kind of, we have banned a few of those sites, I think, social media sites. So let's start off with the 5 and the 8 precepts. Are they found? Where are they found? And the 8 precepts are found in the suttas in quite a number of places. And this was a standard already laid down at the time of the Buddha, that when lay people went to the monastery, they would keep these 8 precepts. And there's some nice suttas about that where the Buddha says to the lay people that the arahants keep these 8 precepts. So if you keep these 8 precepts, you are acting like an arahant for one night or for one day. Yeah, that's quite nice, isn't it? The arahants keep them all the time, and now for one night you keep them as well. So kind of you feel like you're walking in the footsteps of the arahant. Maybe even the footsteps of the Buddha if you keep on practicing like that. So that is there. The 5 precepts are they found in the suttas? I don't think they are found quite in that way. What is the nearest we get to the 5 precepts in the suttas? I think it is. What is the nearest we get to the 5 precepts in the suttas? It is. I'm not sure where the five precepts, where they occur for the first time. I'm not sure about that, and I can't tell you off the top of my head. Do you know where it is? Where in? Four, like where? Yeah. Well, the four is more important because when we're drinking is actually quite rare in the suttas, and that's kind of the interesting thing about it. It doesn't occur so often, but the eight is certainly there. So I cannot answer that question where the five comes from, but I know that the eight is found in there. So,
Well, if
it's
eight there, it includes five.
It includes five, but the thing is, but that is for the Uposatha, you have the eight precepts. The five is supposed to keep all the time, yeah? So the question is, where does it come from? Where does it come from as a separate group that is supposed to be kept all the time? Because it's a different thing. It does include the five, but it doesn't really give a specific direction about it, how it is to be used and what it is for. Anyway, so maybe... yeah, I don't know the answer straight away, but let's just leave it aside for now. Maybe one of... Yeah. Let's rather move to the next one, which is... Yeah, please, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the brothers actually brought a computer about that one. Because we had a discussion about whether drinking alcohol in moderation, whether that was permitted.
Yeah.
And he directed me to the sutta Sarakana.
Oh, sorry,
FN 55.24.
Yeah. Yeah.
And supposedly the Buddha said he was a stream winner.
Yeah.
And the Sakyans were complaining that he, this Sakarina, used to drink alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
How could he become a stream winner?
Yeah.
Even though he was drinking alcohol.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is a well-known sutta. Exactly. I know about that sutta because these are the kind of suttas that have been controversial probably since the time of the Buddha. So they have probably been discussed over 2,500 years. This kind of suttas. And yes, and that is an interesting one. So how do we explain that? And the way that sutta is phrased, it is a little bit hard to see exactly at what point he became a stream entry. It looks on that sutta, if my memory serves me right, which is possible, but not entirely so sure, that he became a stream entry at the time when he died. Yeah, so at the time, I think that's what happened. When he was passing away, he died. So he may have been drinking all that along, but he may have been a good person in other respects. And at the moment he died, presumably he gave up drinking a few days before he died. So he had... Yeah. Don't drink to the last minute, is a bad idea. So then he probably had some kind of remorse for the drinking, and he gave it up in a more thorough sense, also mentally. And then somehow, because he had the right qualities at that time, he was able to attain stream entry. And I think this is one of the points about drinking. Drinking alcohol is not in itself considered bad karma. It is considered bad because you tend to be deluded about what is right and what is wrong. So you act wrongly. It is called the madhya. Sura, Merya, Madhya, Pamadatana. Sura and Merya and Madhya, all of those three mean alcohol. And Pamadatana means that which is the basis for negligence, basically. Yeah? So they are the basis for negligence, and that is why it is considered bad. But in its own right, it's not considered very severe bad karma or anything like that. One of the problems with alcohol that is pointed out in the suttas is there is a tendency never to have enough of it. You always want more. Yeah, it's like you can never really drown out your sorrows fully by alcohol. And that's often why people drink, because there's too much dukkha in their life or whatever. And then you always want more, and it kind of carries on. And sometimes it creates that habit, obviously. You become an alcoholic even. And that is kind of the scary thing about it. Once you get used to the taste, and get used to the idea, and you kind of enjoy the intoxication to some extent, it carries on also in your next life. Yeah? It's a habit that you bring with you into the future. And then if it always keeps growing, it is quite scary. There is no limit in a sense. So these are the kind of things that I think there are very good reasons for not drinking. These are the kind of things that I would say you should not drink. Is it against the precepts to drink in moderation? The precept says you should abstain from alcohol and drinks that lead to intoxication. It can be understood in two ways, that you drink to such an extent that it leads to intoxication, or you should abstain completely because by its nature they tend to lead to intoxication. And I think that the right way of interpreting and understanding is that you should abandon all alcohol, basically. That's what I think is the meaning of the phrase. I can't remember off the top of my head why I think that. I think there is a once you look at the phrase, I think that is the most likely meaning of the words in that particular combination. But I can't tell you off the top of my head why that is the case. So the Sarakani phrase, the Sarakani one, is strange. It is unusual, but I don't think it means, you know, because of that, that alcohol is actually acceptable. He may not have been keeping the five precepts. That's what I would reckon was the problem. He should have. Maybe he would have become a stream mentor long ago. He had to wait till he died. You know, that's a possibility. You just don't know what is going on here. So.
Thank you.
I read somewhere. I don't remember a long time. It said that the five precepts is not exclusively Buddhist.
Not exclusively Buddhist. So who else has it?
Maybe the Brahmins.
The Brahmins?
The Brahmins?
Yeah.
I read a long time ago, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah.
I don't know of anything else, but there are. I think the Jains had precepts that were quite similar to the Buddhist. They were quite similar. I don't think it may not have been exactly similar, but quite similar. So, there's no reason why the five precepts should be exclusively Buddhist, because they are kind of moral conduct, and they are conduct that most people probably might believe in. Except for drinking. Drinking is not necessarily common. There's no particular reason why they should have to be exclusively Buddhist. It is quite conceivable that they might also relate to others. Then obviously in Christianity they don't have five precepts because they believe in killing animals and they believe in drinking. Yeah, that's considered acceptable. So Christianity is certainly different. Okay, so should addiction to social media, gambling, chasing after the latest trend be considered intoxication? It is definitely intoxication, or it can be, depending on how you use it. So I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think whether it should be excluded or not, you cannot really expand the precepts. Yeah, they are given by the Buddha. It says specifically alcohol. So that is what the precepts are. And there's always going to be a degree of intoxication in life. You cannot get away from intoxication altogether. Intoxication with various things. Just the sensual pleasures is an intoxication already. So there is a cut-off point where you have to kind of decide that these are intoxications that are outside of the precepts. Because they are, you know, there must be a cut-off point somewhere, otherwise you can't do anything. Yeah, you have to eat kind of rice, white rice and water all the time, because live in a cardboard box, because otherwise you might get intoxicated with all the sensuality in the world. So there is a cut-off point where you have to say that, okay, this is no longer part of the precepts. It doesn't mean we can do whatever we want. We still have to be careful, and maybe the best thing is to kind of delete your Facebook account. Yeah, I don't know. When you read about Facebook, it sounds like a pretty dodgy organization anyway, so maybe the best kind of to get out of that as soon as possible. And I've never had a Facebook account in my life, and it's actually, I think, I don't know, I have no idea what it's like, but I'm quite happy without it. I don't really need Facebook to make my life kind of work. It's quite nice to be off social media, I think. I have an email account, that's pretty much as far as my social media interaction goes. Email, don't do anything more than that usually. So sometimes I think it improves the quality of your life when you delete these things. Yeah, get rid of them, chuck them out the window. It may not be a bad thing. It can be hard to do, but many people say they have better life after they do that. Anyway. Yes, why again? Oh, sorry, you're first, yeah.
No. What about smoking cigarette? Does it come under fifth precepts?
I don't think so, because it's supposed to lead to a delusion, yeah, and majja, pamadatana, and smoking does not usually lead to kind of delusion in the same way as alcohol. With alcohol, you really lose your bearings sometimes. You don't know what you're doing anymore. I remember when I was a university student, I used to drink a little bit too much a few times. And really, you lose your ability to think properly, you know, if you drink a little bit too much. So it actually has a very bad consequences on you. Whereas smoking a cigarette doesn't have that same effect on you. So I would say no. But obviously, I think that as a monastic, you have a certain obligation to be a good example to the world. So I think that as a monastic, when we know the health effects of cigarette smoking are pretty bad, yeah, we know that, we shouldn't do it simply for that reason, that you don't want to be a bad example for the world around us. And I know one of the monks in Amman, he used to smoke, and he used to say, yeah, but all the kind of the Kubla Ajahn, the kind of big Ajahn, they used to smoke, so I demand to smoke because of that. This was an example of how kind of these things carry on from one to another one. But the reason why these Ajahns in Thailand smoked was because they started before, they didn't know anything about the health effects, yeah, they started back in the 60s or whatever, before that time, so you kind of, so you know, fair enough, but I don't think we should follow in the same way here. I think Wei Yin was first, so maybe Wei Yin can go first, yeah.
What, I'm just wanting to tell you that I use Facebook.
Uh-huh.
I use it to record all the. It's like my notebook for
notebook,
all
okay. Okay. So there is wholesome and unwholesome ways of using Facebook.
Exactly.
Use it in a wholesome way. Yeah, exactly. Like so many things, it's how you use it that matters. Yeah. Good. Okay.
You know, under the precept?
Yeah.
There's in Thailand, we have some kind of dessert that is. You know, fermented.
Yeah.
If you keep it for many days, you know, it could be like an alcohol.
Uh-huh.
Made of like a sweet rice.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a dessert.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't know if it's allowable or not.
If it has alcohol, you
it's
yeah.
Sweet, but you know, if you keep it many days, it could become like alcohol.
Yeah, so you have to be careful. If you think that there is alcohol in there, then you shouldn't take it. If you know pretty sure that there is not, then it's okay. Yeah. So you have to kind of make your best judgment. You can't just take it, you know, it's not yes or no. You have to kind of judge for yourself whether it is likely to have alcohol or not. That is what you have to do in that situation.
It's not like, but it could taste a little bit, you know.
If it tastes like alcohol, you shouldn't have it. You shouldn't have it. If it tastes like alcohol, it's...
It's kind of sweet and sour.
Yeah.
I don't know how they make it, but it's a sweet rice, steam it,
it sounds like you're trying to find an excuse. Sorry, I'm being naughty.
Traditional Thai dessert,
yeah,
and it's not common nowadays.
Okay.
Only you know the old, very old generation, they know how to make.
Okay.
In the new generation, they don't know.
Don't have it. Okay. Yeah. If you can smell or taste alcohol, then it's already too far. Yeah. This is one of the rules for the monastics. If you can't smell or taste alcohol, then you shouldn't take it. Like in a medicine, for example, which is alcoholic, if you can smell or taste, you shouldn't take it. This is actually there, right there in the alcohol, in the rules. So you have to be careful. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. You okay, Barbara? Yeah? You answered already. Yeah. That's what you have Kalanamitta for. This is what you can just ask your person next to you. Even better. That's great. Okay, so next question. Are you okay with that one? Everyone happy? Yeah? Okay. Next one. Ajahn, can insight be gained from contemplation without or through meditation. Thank you. Can insight be gained? Well, it depends what you mean by insight. And this is kind of the word. A word such as vipassana means something like clear seeing. In my opinion, it does not really mean insight. Insight is more like wisdom. It's like insight means, wow, now I see. It's like the light bulb going up, going on. You know the cartoon, when they had to draw cartoons, they draw comics, and someone had a light bulb going on next to the head. Bing! Yeah? Insight. That's what insight is. So it's like a moment of wisdom, a moment of understanding. But vipassana is more like a continuous thing. The mind clears up, and then it becomes more clear, and then you see things more, you understand things more. It's a gradual thing, more clarity about what is going on. So can insight be had through without meditation? It depends what you mean by insight, and it depends what you mean by these things. But as you keep the precepts, as you purify yourself by being more kind and more mindful, as you overcome the defilements of the mind by thinking in the right way, you actually gain more clarity. Yeah, you gain more. You start to see the things more, the world in a better way, because defilements are disappearing. You become more balanced as a person, all of these kind of things. So just by being kinder, more gentle, more caring, less defiled person, actually you have more clarity about the world around you and also about yourself. Yes, and this way you have more vipassana just by living in a good way. But if you want, if what you mean by insight here is like a profound understanding of the nature of reality, like becoming a stream mentor or something like that, if that is what you mean, then the answer is probably no, because you need samadhi to be able to have insight. And to gain samadhi, you need this incredible peace and stillness inside. And whether you do that through meditation practice or you can perhaps be done by listening to the Dhamma and then going inside of yourself, yeah? But either way, the process is basically the same, and the process of peace is like a meditative process, and you have to go through that process, otherwise you don't get that peace, you don't get the samadhi. So if you want real insight, the real deep ones, then the answer is basically yes, you need to do meditation in one way or another to make the mind peaceful enough for it to for you to be able to see those things and make the mind powerful enough, happy enough, clear enough, and all of these kind of things. So again, remember, all of these things, they come in various degrees, and depending on the degree, you need more calm, more stillness. Yes? No? Maybe? Yeah? All of the above? Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn, is the Heart Sutra one of the original teachings of the Buddha? What do you think? You think it's original? Have you read the Heart Sutra? The Heart Sutra is a sutra from the Prajna Paramita tradition. And belongs to that. It is like a contraction of the Prajnaparamita Sutra. It contains, I haven't read it, but apparently it contains the essential teachings of Prajnaparamita. It's one of the most important suttas in Mahayana Buddhism. As such, it is not really early Buddhism, not part of the early Buddhist teachings. But some of the content may still be compatible with the early Buddhist teachings. And this is one of those things, just because something is a Mahayana teaching doesn't mean that it necessarily is wrong or it is, you know, contradictory to what the Buddha taught. It doesn't necessarily mean that. What it means is that it is often has elements that are further developed, but some of the elements may be early. Often the way that texts develop is very complicated. They often use early ideas and take them further, for example. It doesn't mean that everything is wrong, but it may mean that certain things are additions, for example. So, and this is the problem, because they are additions, maybe they are not quite right, or maybe they are slightly misleading, or we don't know who exactly gave us these ideas, because we don't know who they are. It's kind of all a bit uncertain. And that's why it is better to come back to the early teachings. So if you like the Heart Sutra and you think there are some good things in there, you know, you can read it. Just be aware that it may not be 100% the way the Buddha would have phrased things. Okay. This is going very fast, yeah, which is good, I suppose. Yeah. Dear Ajahn, can you kindly do the sharing of merits to my lay Buddhist teacher, Chua Kar Leong? Chua Kar Leong, okay. He served the Buddhist society in my hometown selflessly for many years. Now he is advanced in age, approaching 90, and is undergoing radiotherapy for his stage 3 prostate cancer. Okay, thank you very much. Of course, we'll be very happy to do that. So I'll put him down on our chanting list, and then we'll do some chanting for him and share merits with him. Actually, we will share some merits at the end, very end here as well, and then you can keep him in mind, and you can share the merits with him as we do that. But I will put him especially on the next to it here, so I can remember what's going on. Okay. Next question. Which would be the main teachings and related sutta a student of the Dhamma should focus on just to get the necessary knowledge for the practice? That's a good question. After all these suttas, you wonder, whoa, so many suttas, which one should we focus on? And I would say one of the suttas that I usually use as the foundation for meditation retreats, because I think it is very practical and very gives all the information you need, is the gradual training. That's what I usually focus on. Not the Satipatthana Sutta so much, because Satipatthana Sutta is one small fraction of the path. It is the mindfulness part. But the gradual training gives you the whole path laid out. It's like the Eightfold Path, but explained systematically, one step after the other. And that would be like Majjhima Nikaya 27, the simile, the shortest sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint, the one we were just reading from at the very end there, yeah, that has the whole practice in there, starting with how you become a disciple of the Buddha all the way to you become an arahant and all the steps in between. It's a very, very useful sutta, and it's really nice for using when you do meditation retreats, especially when you have more focus on meditation practice. It's a very, very useful one. So that is a nice one, but I think it is nice to sometimes read a little bit more broadly in the suttas, because some of the things that are really important, for example, to get started, is the idea of right view. And our modern idea of views, the way we view the world in the modern world, is often very different from the way they viewed the world at the time of the Buddha. Things like rebirth and karma, for example, are essential part of the Buddha's teachings. But in the modern world, rebirth and karma are kind of not really all that common. A lot of people kind of reject these things. So for that reason, sometimes we need a bit more in the modern world to be able to really appreciate these suttas. You need to straighten out your view more to be clear about what matters. Where should our priorities lie? What values should we hold? And all of these kind of things. And all of that comes out of reading the suttas and getting this right view as a foundation stone. So I wouldn't recommend just reading one sutta. That is a very practical one, but I would broaden out a little bit. One nice book to start with that I sometimes recommend to people is In the Buddha's Words. It is an anthology, a collection of suttas that are thematically put together. So you have various themes. Yeah, it is done by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the main translators of suttas, usually very good translations, and lots of introductory explanations, lots of footnotes, and done in the language is quite accessible, so fairly easy to understand what is happening here. So this is where I would start, read Majjhima 27, and then gradually see what happens. You can also read the suttas on suttacentral.net. suttacentral.net, Sutta Central, CENTRAL, Central. And there you have the translation of the whole Tipitaka, I think, even. At least it's certainly coming, but all the suttas are there, and then you can kind of gradually go through it and enjoy the suttas. And if you don't enjoy it, just skip it and go to the next one. That's my recommendation. Don't read if you don't enjoy it. So that's what I recommend. Yes? Okay. Uh, So the, you know, the, just the necessary knowledge for practice is very hard to pin down. What is the exactly the necessary knowledge for practice? It depends really on the person, depends on so many factors. You can't really pin it down quite like that, I think. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is the right attitude towards our work which gives us stress and anxiety? How do we apply Dhamma to this? Okay, so what is the right attitude towards work that gives you stress and anxiety? Well, one of the things, the reason why things give us stress and anxiety is often because of how we relate to that work. And one of the ways of relating to work that will reduce the stress is to think that it doesn't matter if I get lose my job or not. Yeah, if you think that it doesn't matter if you lose a job, then when other people kind of when people push you too hard and to do whatever, then you just shrug your shoulders. Yeah, say okay, whatever. If I lose my job, it doesn't matter, you know. And then you don't allow yourself to be stressed out so much by all these deadlines and being pushed around by people around you. And that is kind of a nice thing. But in the end, a job is useful because we have to make a living and all of that. But it's not kind of, it's not, you know, it's not what life is about. Yeah, having the right job. And sometimes we are in the wrong job, perhaps, with the wrong people around us. Sometimes we should perhaps give up our job voluntarily. Say, enough of this. Yeah, the work environment here is too hectic. And then you downgrade instead of being too, too ambitious in your job or whatever. You kind of, you know, you become maybe something else. You start kind of, working in a simple little place. You come here to the BGF and you kind of wash the floors here in BGF instead. Yeah, that kind of job. Yeah, that is much much nicer. So you do something like that, and then you kind of downgrade. You don't. One of the problems we get stressed and anxiety because we are ambitious as well. We want to get it right. We want to do it this way, and we want to have this kind of work. We don't want to work in some kind of lowly occupation. But actually, lowly occupation is good. Yeah, have a lowly occupation, which is where kind of there is less work hours and you can kind of relax more. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's fine. And I know people. There's one fellow in Perth. He used to be a lawyer. And he got so stressed out of being a lawyer that he gave it up, and then he started to care for the handicapped people instead. So now he cares for handicapped people, which is kind of like a government job, so much easier, much more relaxing. And he is a much happier person as a consequence. He doesn't make a fraction of the money, but he doesn't really care about money, so it doesn't matter. So this is the way you have to just establish what is really valuable in your life, what matters the most, and then you downgrade certain things and you upgrade other things instead. How do we apply Dhamma to this? So this is maybe what you do, and if you know, all of these teachings of the Dhamma, they help you to deal with anxiety and stress. If you have more metta to the people around you, if you have more compassion to the people around you, if you understand them more, yeah, then they will also stress you out much less. If someone is kind of speak to you in an unfriendly way and that becomes stressful, if you have metta and compassion towards them, it doesn't bother you anymore. And you kind of just shrug your shoulders and you carry on like you did before pretty much. So there you are. So that is one possibility with that one. Okay, last question. Dear Ajahn, if someone is of a different faith or who has a wrong view, it may be disagreeable to that person if the person hears the Dhamma. Is this wrong speech if our intention is to help this person attain right view? I think you have to know the right time. If you want to help somebody else, you have to do it at the right time. And if you do it at the wrong time, sometimes it comes counterproductive. So they have to have at least some interest. Yeah. And if you force too much the views onto other people, actually they become rebellious and they kind of become resistant towards hearing anything instead. So be a little bit sensitive and be gentle with other people. It is not necessarily wrong, but if you can do it in a way whereby they don't are so resistant, it is better. Start with something nice. Start with some of Ajahn Brahm's stories. Yeah, they are so neutral. They're almost non-religious. Some of the stories are just nice stories, and they are regardless of your background, they are acceptable. In Indonesia, Ajahn Brahm's books are bestsellers. Yeah, literally, it's like they are absolutely on top of the bestsellers. You have Ajahn Brahm on top, and then you have Harry Potter number 2, Dan Brown number 3. Yeah, that's how big they are in Indonesia. Absolutely massive, and the whole population reads them. It doesn't matter if they are Muslims or Christians. Everybody reads them. Yeah, because they are nice stories and they are applicable to everyone. Yeah? And so this is nice thing about these things. Anybody can really read them, and this makes makes the stories easy. And this is an easy approach to Dhamma. And this is the thing about Buddhist teachings. They are essentially psychology. It's about how to use our minds in a wise way. So because of that, there's no reason why you can't be both a Christian and a Buddhist at the same time. Yeah, you can, really. Or you can be a Muslim and a Buddhist perhaps at the same time. Perhaps, I don't know. It may not work with everyone, but sometimes it works. Or you can be anything, because psychology is a psychology. It's a way of dealing with your mind. And for that reason, there isn't really any... It doesn't need to be limited off in the same way sometimes as perhaps other faiths need to be limited off. So just be gentle and feel if it is the right time, and if it isn't the right time, then don't do it. And if you can find a gentle way of doing these things, then you can try and see what happens. Is it wrong speech? It is not. If your intention is to help, it is. If your intention is good, it's never wrong speech. It is always good. But be sensitive. Yeah. So don't say, yeah, this is right speech, I'm going to really tell you. Don't think like that. Yeah. Because then it is going to cause more problems as a consequence. So, that is all the questions answered. Any more questions before we call it a day or a week or whatever it is? Anything else? Yes, Barbara.
Yeah, John. Coming back to this phrase, he beats me, he abused me, because that's where I always encounter. So if a spouse were to abuse their partner for many, many years, sometimes 20 years, 30 years, and if he or she keeps on having this attitude of, oh, he beats me, let me accept it, maybe it's my karma, until maybe one day he or she might be suicidal or homicidal. So what does Ajahn view on this?
Yeah, it is. This teaching does not mean that you should just accept things. It doesn't mean that you should just go with what is already there. What it means is more like your mental attitude. So what it means is that if you live in an abusive relationship and that there is no way, but after you understand fairly quickly that this is not going to stop because it already has gone on for a while, and you realize there's only one way, you have to get out of the relationship. That's the only reasonable thing. So if you live in that sort of relationship, don't carry on, because often you live in the stupid hope that maybe it's going to come to an end, but usually it doesn't. It just keeps on going and going and going. So what you do is you get out of the relationship, but you also have the right attitude. You don't think he beat me, abused me. You also learn, ideally, you also learn to forgive at the same time. So you look after yourself and you forgive at the same time. You both go out, leave the relationship, and you forgive. That is the most powerful combination. But you don't allow these things to go on. That is an abuse of the Buddhist teachings. It's the wrong way to think about Buddhism. Not the right way. So you have metta to yourself.
Yes. If the person is a Buddhist, they might be able to accept such thing. But sometimes the person is not a Buddhist. So I have to use other ways, skillful means. What I want to say. So, I have a case where I followed the case for about 10 years. Because the children were young and her job is not that the income from the job will not be able to sustain her or the children if she leaves. So in that case, so she find it difficult to leave.
Yeah.
And has to live with it and get a lot of support from the community.
From what?
From the community.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes no family support.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. So, exactly. It's often very difficult, yeah, and these things make it more complicated because you have to look after your children. You have to make sure your children kind of are looked after properly, so it makes it very hard. And so it is a very difficult calculation, so you have to kind of weigh everything up somehow and then decide what to do on that basis. But it shouldn't be the case that you have to live in an abusive relationship almost regardless. You really want to avoid that because it is so destructive in the long run. Also, even for your children, you know, if you live in an abusive relationship, your children will probably know about it, what's going on. And because they know it, it's also very bad for them as well, you know. So sometimes then it's better to live in a bit more poverty, but outside of that relationship, than to actually carry on, because it's bad for everyone involved. But it is, of course, it's difficult, always very hard. And that's why people stay in these relationships, even though it is so much suffering. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Yeah. Yes. Okay, yeah.
Ajahn, I just want to ask something, Ajahn. This open awareness, do we actually meditate? I know we were taught, like, meditate with open eyes. Yeah, that is sampajana, some kind of. When you meditate, you don't focus. It's kind of like not focusing on anything, but just look into your mind, but actually opening your eyes.
Yeah, it depends. Okay. Depends what you want to do. It depends what you want to achieve. If all you want to achieve is to kind of get to know your mind and get to know your content of your thoughts and find out what your defilements are a bit, you can do that in many contexts. You can just go for a walk in the forest, yeah? If it's peaceful and nice and you have self-awareness, you can have some awareness of what's going on. Or you can just sit there in a chair and just relax, yeah? Not doing anything in particular, and you can have awareness of your mind. Whether you can call that meditation or not is a different question. I don't know, you know, whether it's really meditation. Usually when the Buddha talks about meditation, it means bhavana is sitting down, you know, and being aware of your breath or something like that.
So it means you have to close your eyes or very individual? Because,
It depends what you want to do. If you want to watch the breath, absolutely you should close your eyes. To watch the breath without closing your eyes is almost impossible because it's so distracting. Yeah. But it depends again what you want to do. You can't practice the Dhamma with eyes open because we do that all the time. Yeah, we always try to be virtuous and kind and change our thinking habits, and we do that normally when our eyes are open. So you can do things with your eyes open. It just depends on what exactly that it is that you're aiming at. So open awareness with open eyes is something you can do, but it's not going to lead to the same results as watching the breath with eyes closed. They are different things, done at different times, for different purposes. And that's what you have to be aware of. Yeah?
For many years, when I first started,
yeah.
I didn't close my eyes completely.
Yeah. Yeah. It does, but you don't know whether he's meditating or not, yeah? So you're not sure. Sure, why not? You know, you start with that and then you kind of move on. Of course you can, yeah. No problems. So it's a gradual thing here, yeah. 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 Yeah.
Hopefully next year you'll come back. And next year give them an exam about this year topic.
Say again?
Give them examinations.
Examinations. Yeah.
Oral.
Yeah.
Not written.
Oral, okay. Yeah.
They worth your effort.
Yeah. The examination is I come here, and if people kind of are kind and they're friendly and they do the right thing, then they have passed the exam. Yeah. That is the way. Yeah.
I also like to thank the you know, everything, especially the BGS people, I'm thinking that, allow me to be here and, you know, join with you all here. And thank Ajahn Brahmi for, you know, your teaching.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming. It's nice to have a bikini as well, yeah? It's not every day you get the chance to have a bikini, so that's really nice, yeah. David, oh, sorry, Linda, you want to say, okay? Yeah.
I'm talking about this Facebook. Ajahn doesn't have a Facebook account, yeah. But I don't know whether whether you realize that there is a Ajahn Brahm's fan club.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Ajahn Brahm's fan club, where you can find a lot of information about Ajahn Brahmali.
Yeah.
Yeah, like where you go, you know. Like, you know, you're going to England, you know, to give talks or you know, things like that. Yeah, yeah. So we know your movements. not hugging you though, but then, you know, it's nice to know that then some of the participants, they do put in a Facebook, you know, the talks and all that.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
so
okay.
In addition to that, we can also okay. Learn. Yeah.
Good. No, that's good. I don't mind that at all. If people want to do that, that's up to them, you know. But I have nothing to do with it, so that's okay. Yeah,
yeah, thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Ajahn, just wanting to go back onto the about meditation, about having the eyes closed. I read somewhere in the suttas that the Buddha said there's 40 meditation objects. I think it's about 10 kasinas, and 6 of the kasinas you can use to get all the way through to the 4 dhyanas.
Yeah.
So when you were saying about meditating with eyes closed,
yeah,
to get deep samadhi, then I assume the kasinas, you have to have your eyes open to actually meditate. So I wonder what your thoughts were on these objects where you need your eyes open.
Well, with the kasinas, you start off with your eyes open, and until you get a mental image. Yeah, and then once you get the mental image, then you will close your eyes, because then the external becomes a distraction from the mental image. So it's you use that as a preliminary to give rise to the mental image, and then you close your eyes, and then you take it into the jhanas after that. So it's kind of a stage-wise process. But it's true, in that kind of situation, you would start with your eyes open, so part of the meditation, you will develop presumably quite a bit of stillness already with your eyes open, that kind of situation. But the kasinas are... they are very kind of peripheral in the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, they are listed in a few places, but not really explained very much. And the place where the kasinas become very important is in the Visuddhimagga, because in the Visuddhimagga, the entire path to jhana is explained in terms of the earth kasina. You use the earth kasina to kind of give rise to the first jhana. That's where it really becomes explained in detail. But in the suttas, there's almost no explanation. They're just given a list of 10 kasinas, different colors, space, and consciousness, and these kind of things. But beyond that, you don't really know much about them. So sometimes you wonder whether the kasinas were a Buddhist invention or whether they existed in India prior to that, and then maybe they were taken on board by the Buddhists because they could be used for samadhi, just to kind of, you know, have the full specter of meditation exercises, possibly. So I don't know how Buddhist even they are, to be honest with you, but they have been drawn in like that. But they are... Yeah, they are peripheral, and you're right though, that in that case, normally you would start with your eyes open, yeah, yeah. Okay, anyone else? Everyone is, does that mean you are tired or mean you're happy? And so, okay, bit of both, tired kind of happiness. Anyone else wants to say anything here? No, everyone is okay here. Okay, so so in that case, I should say it has been very nice to be here as usual in the BGS. one of the great benefits of being a monk, that whenever you travel in the world, all you ever meet is nice people. Yeah, everyone is usually nice. And that is the nice thing. You meet good Buddhist people everywhere, even in places like Norway, which is kind of far away, cold, and really, even there you meet nice Buddhist people. So this is one of the benefits that no one is aware of becoming a Buddhist monk, that you actually meet so many nice people in your life. I didn't know that before I ordained. If I had known that, I would have ordained maybe even earlier, because it's such a nice thing. So I wish you all well, and just remember, just the most important thing on the Buddhist path is just commitment and perseverance. If you commit and you persevere, then you will have success. And the way to commit and persevere is just to continuing to study the Dhamma, to listen to the word of the Buddha, and then allow yourself gradually to be brainwashed by that beautiful word of the Buddha. And as you do so, then this whole thing tends to come together. That's all. So good luck, everyone, and enjoy. And then maybe, who knows, maybe we'll see you again next year. Bobby.
Sadhu. Dear Chan, on behalf of all the participants here and the organizers, we'd like to say a big thank you to Achan. Sadhu. And also, we'd like to have a group photo with Achan. And before that, could Achan lead us in the sharing of merits?
Of course, yeah, sharing merits we shall do. Yeah, absolutely. So this sharing of merits is also for Chua Ka Leong. Okay. So let's do the sharing of merit together. Hedang men yati nang ho tu sukita hon tu nyata yo. Edang me nyati nang ho tu sukita hon tu nyata yo. Edang me nyati nang ho tu sukita hon tu nyata yo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Let's pay respect to the Buddha as well. Should we do that while we're at it? Just the last time.